The headlines: Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro arrives in the Iranian capital, Tehran, for an official visit aimed at strengthening bilateral ties. Hezbollah warning Israel over its illegal gas drilling operation. The movement says it has enough power to stop Israel from plundering Lebanon's wealth. And also, the Ukrainian president says his forces are holding on in the flashpoint eastern city of Severodonetsk, the focal point of the recent fighting with Russia. Hello and welcome, everybody. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has arrived in Iran at the head of a high-ranking politico-economic delegation. Maduro is on a two-day visit at the invitation of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi. The Venezuelan president will meet his Iranian counterpart and participate in a meeting of high-ranking officials from the two countries. Iran and Venezuela have both been targeted by U.S. sanctions, particularly in the energy sector. They've been closely cooperating to counter the effects of such economic pressure. In a phone call with his Venezuelan counterpart in December, Raisi said Venezuela is targeted by the U.S. because of its quest for independence and freedom. Raisi lauded the Tehran-Caracas relations as strategic, underlining the need for the development of mutual ties, especially in trade and economy. Relations between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency have turned sour after the agency passed a resolution against Tehran this week. Iranians have reason to be outraged by the IAEA's accusation of lack of cooperation.
Since July 2015, when the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action came into existence, Iran's nuclear program has been open to inspections described as unprecedented in the history of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Under that agreement, Tehran voluntarily agreed to grant international inspectors easy access to its atomic sites well beyond its IAEA obligations. The agency was also allowed to install many more surveillance cameras at Iranian sites. The IAEA's inspections in Iran account for over a quarter of all agencies' monitoring activity around the world. Despite the close cooperation, the International Atomic Energy Agency is once again accusing Iran of failing to cooperate. This week, the IAEA's Board of Governors passed a resolution critical of Iran. The resolution was sponsored by the United States, Britain, France, and Germany. The agency says it is not satisfied with the answers Iran has provided to its probes of three sites. The resolution has been described as a blow to the stalled talks between Iran and the P4+1 group to revive the moribund 2015 deal. The IAEA resolution criticizing Iran was passed amid an intensified Israeli lobbying campaign to derail diplomacy with Iran. Israel is a sworn enemy of the hard-earned 2015 deal and makes no secret of its efforts to destroy it completely. The IAEA's Board of Governors passed its latest resolution just days after IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi visited Israel. Iran is also highly critical of the IAEA for failing to even raise the issue of Israel's nuclear weapons program during Grossi's recent visit. The atomic agency's credibility and impartiality are on the line as it seems to be yielding to pressure by nuclear-armed Israel to mount pressure on Iran.
But I do agree that Iran has good reason to be angry with the resolution, because it is an extension of the one rule for us and a different rule for you approach that's been taken by the IAEA with respect to Iran from the beginning of this entire issue. Iran has the right to develop nuclear technology. Iran has complied with inspections. And what appears to be the case here is that Israel and the United States are together attempting to restrict Iran's development as a nuclear power.
Iran has been unrelenting in pursuing its rights. In response to the IAEA's resolution, President Ebrahim Raisi says Iran will insist on its rights until they are fulfilled. Meanwhile, the Iranian nuclear chief has sharply criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency, warning that the IAEA is caught in the clutches of Zionists. The Israeli pressure seems to be aimed at making it impossible to restore the JCPOA.
After years of unprecedented inspections in its nuclear sites, the Iranian government seems to be outraged by the IAEA's censure. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi pledged that such measures will never force Iran to back down from its rights. Meanwhile, head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, says it is unfortunate that the IAEA is being exploited by an illegitimate regime. He demanded the agency put a stop to infiltration by Iran's enemies in its operations. As tensions between Iran and the agency soared this week, Tehran informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that it is disconnecting over 24 surveillance cameras that were installed in Iran beyond the country's IAEA obligations. Iran is also installing 2 new cascades of the IR-6 advanced centrifuges at its Natanz atomic fuel production facility. The Iranian atomic chief has said that Iran provided accurate answers to IAEA questions, but the agency lacks the will to declare Iran's answers convincing. Iran argues that the IAEA's focus on the country is discriminatory because it accounts for only a small amount of global nuclear activity and is undergoing hundreds of inspections per year. Negotiators from Iran and the P4+1 have held a year of intense negotiations to try to find a way to restore the JCPOA, but talks have stalled since March. The latest episode between Iran and the IAEA could further complicate the negotiations. Observers believe that the IAEA is pushing things in the direction favored by Israel.
Well, I believe that the resolution, which is primarily aimed at disrupting Iran's nuclear development program, is just part of a broader program of regional hegemony on the part of Israel. This program of regional hegemony has been supported by the United States in the past, and in fact, Israel was a prime mover in having the United States invade Iraq on the false pretense of weapons of mass destruction. I'm deeply concerned, and I must say I'm far more concerned than the IAEA could be about Iran's nuclear development program. I am much more concerned than that about the potential for Israel developing this issue via its supporters in the United States and via its own Israel lobby in America to bring the entire region into a potential state of war.
Members of the MKO terrorist group attack for the second straight day an exhibition held in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, on the crimes committed by the group. The MKO agents are trying to stop the event by ripping down the banners of the exhibition. One person has reportedly been arrested. The organizers of the exhibition say the Swedish police are refusing to provide better security for the event. The members of the terrorists called mobbed the exhibition on Thursday, too, tearing down the banners and splashing paint on them. They also violently assaulted the reporter and accompanying news team of Press TV, as well as other participants. The notorious group launched a campaign of bombings and assassinations in Iran, mostly in the 1980s. It's currently based in Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activity.
This is the moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera.
Go deep.
Don't touch my camera.
You go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior for women that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the U.S. terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Mariam Rajavi has forged close relationships with Western officials.
What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has urged Israel to stop extracting gas from a maritime field in disputed waters.
The immediate objective should be to prevent the enemy from extracting oil and gas from the Karsh gas field and to stop this activity that will and may have begun. The resistance will not stand by and do nothing in the face of Israel's looting of Lebanon's natural wealth, the looting of Lebanon's treasure, which is the only hope for the salvation of the Lebanese people. It will not stand idly by.
Nasrallah described Israel's operation in the disputed waters as an act of provocation. He also warned a Greek company hired by Israel against proceeding with its activities. Nasrallah said the company is a partner in the Israeli aggression and urged the firm to pull out its ship immediately. The Hezbollah chief said Lebanon has the right to exploit natural resources from the field, stressing that the movement has the capacity to prevent Israel from extracting gas there. At the weekend, an Israeli floating gas production unit arrived in the disputed maritime zone. The move sparked anger of the Lebanese government, which warned Israel against any aggressive actions. Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, tells us more about Hezbollah's stance on the dispute with Israel. She says the movement has compared the dispute with Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon and has called on people and officials to be united.
It seems Hezbollah is eyeing the situation quite closely. And what we have from Hezbollah right now is a quite official statement from its side. Of course, they said they will not take part. They will not interfere in any of the demarcation process. But he also called on the officials to be united. And he also called on the Lebanese people to be united behind this national cause, which is very significant. He compared this new phase that Lebanon is entering right now to the 1982 Israeli invasion, which reached the capital, Beirut. So this is quite significant when it comes to what the nation is looking at right now. We're looking at natural resources that could be looted at any moment, even if the ship does stand in disputed areas, not in areas that are Lebanese, but they have the capability to basically suck out all the natural resources that are across the coastal line of Lebanon. Now, the ship that reached the near the field of Karish is UK-based, as you mentioned, but it's also owned by a Greek Israeli. So that also gives Hezbollah leverage. Of course, he had clearly warned that ship that they need to leave the area, that as long as this is called disputed by the Lebanese government, then therefore they should not have the right, just as Lebanon does not have the right.
Israel has conducted yet another airstrike on Syria, this time in the south of the capital, Damascus. The Syrian government says it was a missile attack and left a civilian injured. It says the missiles were fired from the occupied Golan Heights. The Syrian air defense is down most of them. The attack caused material damage to Israel frequently. Israel frequently attacks Syria, but rarely claims responsibility. Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out the attacks to aid terrorist groups fighting the Syrian army. Syria says the Israeli raids violate its sovereignty and territorial integrity and has repeatedly complained to the UN over the attacks. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are holding on in the flashpoint eastern city of Severodonetsk, the focal point of fighting with Russia over the past few weeks. Zelensky says Ukrainian forces are also holding on in several more cities in the eastern Donbas region, liberating their land. Donbas has been the scene of intense fighting taking place in different cities, with Severodonetsk witnessing the fiercest battles. Russia now controls most of the city. The governor of Severodonetsk says the latest Russian attacks have burned down a major sports complex there. Severodonetsk is located in Luhansk province, which Russia says is almost under its full control. Luhansk and Donetsk are two major provinces in Donbas. The war in Ukraine is now in its fourth month. And the European Central Bank has confirmed its intention to hike interest rates at the policy meeting next month. The move is aimed at bringing down soaring prices across the Eurozone. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by 0.25% next month, most likely 0.5% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court. Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO. ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A broken prime minister is still in occupation of Downing Street thanks to a billionaire class who holds a stranglehold over the governing political party, says Peter O'Born, author, in an article published under the heading Boris Johnson, the billionaire's useful idiot. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Welcome to British Politics This Overcast. A broken prime minister is still in occupation of Downing Street and determined to stay there. This is a recipe for, at best, paralysis, at worst, chaos. More likely both. It's hard to see what will make Boris Johnson quit. The prime minister, remember, has powerful allies. Tuesday's Daily Mail, Britain's most well-drilled and powerful popular paper, is an essential read for anyone wishing to understand the near-term trajectory of British politics. It contains a series of brutal hatchet jobs on former Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, Theresa May in trousers, who the Mail accuses of leading the plotters. On its front page, the Mail lacerates the 148 Tory rebels for pressing the self-destruct button by opening the door to smirking Starmer's coalition of chaos. The big newspaper prop writers, Murdoch, Rodermere, and the Barclay family, remain loyal to Johnson. Admittedly, the Times and the Telegraph are tougher than usual on Johnson this morning, but crucially, there are no calls for him to quit. Murdoch, Mail newspapers, and the Barclays are part of Johnson's core political base. They all backed him to be Tory leader, all backed him in the 2019 general election, and all have protected Johnson during the harrowing political scandals that have dogged his premiership. These newspaper magnates are still behind the Prime Minister today. While this remains the case, Johnson can hope to survive. The second half of the coalition backing Johnson are the billionaire Tory donors who funded Brexit and now, in a mutation of democratic politics, effectively own Johnson's Conservative Party. In an unprecedented direct intervention by the super rich in British public life, these donors came together in defense of Johnson. They wrote a letter significantly given as an exclusive to Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper, awarding their unconditional support to Boris Johnson. As the Sun emphasized, this letter was signed by some of the richest men in Britain, including billionaire J.C.B. boss Lord Bamford, property magnate Sir Tony Gallagher, and Corfon warehouse founder David Ross. Other names reported The Sun include multi-millionaire financier Howard Shore and mega-rich Simon Rubin, who alongside brother David is worth £116 billion. The letter, which emphasized the talking points of Johnson's political campaign, announced that Johnson enjoyed the unwavering support of the billionaires who signed it. The authors of the letter seem to have felt no need to say out loud the unspoken threat that they would withhold funds from any Tory leader who dared to supplant Johnson. But the Johnson campaign team felt no such inhibitions. Johnson loyalist Nadine Dorries, Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, went straight onto national TV and in a remarkable statement told the Sky political editor Beth Rigby this: "The Conservative Party donors have said themselves that they aren't going to support the party if the PM is removed. I think a number of MPs in the marginal seats need to hear that and need to understand what they are doing. £80 million... those donors have donated to the Conservative Party over recent times." We can only guess how many Tory MPs were terrified into supporting Johnson by this stark warning, amounting to an attempt at financial blackmail, that Tory donors would stop issuing checks if they voted the wrong way last night. But we can say for certain this was a dark moment in modern British democratic politics. A Tory cabinet minister setting out in stark terms that billionaires hold a stranglehold over the governing political party. We've never seen this openly stated by a senior active Tory politician before. This means it was a revelatory moment that, oh, to redefine the way in which Johnson's premiership should be framed. So far, Johnson's many media allies have presented the Prime Minister as a cheeky chappy with common touch fighting a popular campaign against a distant liberal elite, flawed for certain, a liar and a cheat, but always fighting for ordinary people. That claim has always been misleading. From the start of his premiership, ex-journalist Johnson has been the creature of the big media owners acting in alliance with deracinated financial capital. For all of his incompetence, falsehoods, and lack of vision, Boris Johnson still has their support today. Over the coming weeks, the British media will paint Britain's ongoing political crisis as the story of an embattled Prime Minister fighting a desperate struggle for survival. There is some truth in that dramatic, easily comprehensible narrative, but much greater forces are at work. The billionaire class put their man, Boris Johnson, in Downing Street 3 years ago. He suits them well because he does what they want. Johnson is at the apex of a system of government that hands out contracts, supplies favors, slashes regulation, attacks the rule of law, reduces the right of working people, and favors the marketplace above the state. The brilliance of Boris Johnson is that he does all of this while pretending to be on the side of ordinary working people. That's why the super rich love Boris, the billionaire's useful idiot. For all his faults, let's face it, Johnson was a shambles when he appeared on late-night British TV to declare victory after Tory leadership vote. Disheveled, gibbering, incoherent. This wounded Prime Minister blamed the media, shamelessly linked his fortunes to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, and nonsensically claimed he had more supporters than when elected Tory leader 3 years ago. It made for painful viewing. Johnson has not simply lost the support of more than one-third of his parliamentary party. He's lost contact with reality, but not with the billionaires. The real story of the next few desperate months is not whether Boris Johnson, a truly wretched and discredited political figure, can survive. It's about whether the system of government, in the interest of the super rich he has come to represent, can be overturned.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Another massacre has put the American nation in another state of panic, this time in Texas. An 18-year-old gunman decided to make a bloodbath in a school in Uvalde. He managed to terminate the lives of 19 children and two teachers amid a slow response from police present at the scene. Children inside Robb Elementary School classrooms 111 and 112 repeatedly called for 911 and pleaded for help from authorities, but to no avail. The pro-gun faction's argument in America is that people with weapons could use them to save lives, but in reality, not even police managed to rescue the young children's lives in the presence of a savage shooter.
Uvalde carnage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. This episode is dedicated to the victims of a deadly school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. We'll investigate the mass shooting and the general rise of violence in America, coupled with easy access to guns and police inaction. Most of the politicians are either ignoring the situation or abusing it in favor of their own interests. As any other phenomena in America, this one is also turning into a power play between liberals and conservatives. In this episode, we'll be joined by Karanja K. Takero, faculty member in the Department of Black and Latino Studies at Baruch College, CUNY. His teaching and research interests revolve around African-centered theory and methodology with an emphasis on social and psychological theory. And later in the program, we'll be joined by Rahul Mankata, international law and civil rights attorney out of New York, to get his take on the issue. Please stay tuned.
And in the last 10 days, we've had elderly black people killed in a supermarket in Buffalo. We've had Asian churchgoers killed in Southern California. And now we have children murdered at school. When are we going to do something? I'm tired of the moments of silence. Enough.
The U.S. police is notorious for brutality against protesters and racial minorities. However, in the latest mass shooting, their inaction is what has wreaked havoc. There were nearly 20 law enforcement officers standing in a hallway outside the classroom, and they all failed to take any action as they waited for room keys and tactical equipment to arrive first. The gunman was therefore allowed to get engaged in the atrocity for around one full hour without any real reaction from the cops.
In any country, police are supposed to be ready to sacrifice their own lives in order to save those of children. That obviously did not happen in this mass shooting. American authorities have failed to take any action in the face of repeated mass shootings in the United States. So what are the people to do?
I believe the people, number one, need to become organized. And by them becoming organized, that means that they are a collective that understands what the nature of the problem is and how they go about fixing it. I do not believe that the authorities nor the government will have the answers to fix these random mass shootings and the rampant gun violence within the nation at this point. It is necessary for communities to come together. I am not anti-gun. I am anti-gun violence, but I'm not anti-gun. Arguably, guns do not kill people. People kill people. So it is about people becoming organized and educated that will allow for these issues to decrease.
The slow response has outraged the victims' families, who are demanding action to be taken against the irresponsible police. They have also come face-to-face with the dark reality of deadly weapons and how accessible they are to the youth in the United States. Some of the cops present at the scene reportedly saved their own children from the school and ignored others.
I would argue it's going to be the continued co-option of elected officials. It is going to be business as usual. I don't believe anything will change. I actually think that when incidents like this happen, the gun lobby gets even more powerful because they're trying to get what they believe they've lost due to these type of incidents. Excuse me.
Now, the official story of the school shooting keeps changing, but the parents waiting outside were allegedly threatened with arrest. One cop even brandished a taser gun to stop a parent from attempts to save their own kids themselves. So how can parents make sure that their children do not fall victim to these mass shootings in schools, which have been rather common in recent years?
That's a great question, too, and I thought about that. I think that we're living in an age of such great technology and high technology that I think would be very conceivable to, if you really need to have a gun culture, to install sort of the equipment to detect weapons, detect guns that you have in, say, airports or other areas of high security weapons or gun technology that could detect weapons in school settings. I don't think it would be very expensive to install. That might be the first option, improving technology so that, you know, you could have a school zone and a radius wherein weapons are absolutely not able to be either smuggled in or entered into a school area, just like an airport or any other, you know, federal or governmental building.
Now, the Uvalde school shooting is indeed going to erode trust in police even further. Trust has already lessened after incidents like the murder of George Floyd by a white cop, weakening any incentives for people to cooperate with law enforcement.
Most law enforcement agencies, because of factors including a culture of machismo and a number of legal restraints, do little or no mental health screening for cops when returning from military deployment, and provide little in the way of treatment. And finally, the hiring preferences for former service members that tend to benefit whites disproportionately make it harder to build police forces that resemble and understand diverse communities. So I think that it is the relationship between the military industrial complex and police departments that needs to be understood before or and as we begin to look at what is taking place within these mass shootings.
With police opting not to pursue the shooter into the classroom, there seems to be no way to explain to the parents why and how they lost their children. The U.S. mainstream media is also struggling to find ways to defend police. In reality, neither the Constitution nor state law impose any duty upon police officers or other governmental officials to protect individuals from harm. What is the root cause of violence in America and the urges for savagery to arise in shooters such as Salvador Ramos?
The origins or the roots is connected to the very history of this nation. The very history of the United States is rooted in violence. From the European colonizers who came here and attempted to strip the land from the indigenous people, from the forced labor that they brought from Africans, from the economic system, from issues of racism, sexism, all of them, they are violent in their origin and they are foundational to the United States of America. So the root cause of this is violence within American culture. And this is why I believe that education is essential, is necessary for people to understand and become conscious of the very nature, historical, social historical of history within this nation in order to stop and prevent and begin to challenge manifestations of violence such as this. But I think that violence is at the very foundation of this nation.
The recent school shooting is yet another tragic event added to the long list of school shootings in U.S. history in which innocent children are killed by a deranged shooter. Behind such bloodbath is a labyrinth of power that takes immense profit from the sale of weapons and ammunition.
The Second Amendment is very, very well entrenched into the United States. Obviously, it's the Second Amendment right after the First. So there'll be definitely a hell of a fight. But I think that there's probably an issue with mass populated areas, which have a much greater chance of the American people mobilizing to curtail or ban automatic weapons. The issue is in rural areas. That's really where you have the sort of the Bible Belt. They really hold on to their weapons, and it's sort of like more the frontier mentality over there in the rural areas.
Entities such as the NRA, that's the National Rifle Association, backed by powerful conservative politicians, unabashedly promote the idea of carrying and selling guns, disregarding the gruesome series of mass killings in America. So what is next for powerful pro-gun entities such as the NRA amid brutal shootings such as this recent one we saw in Uvalde, Texas?
Well, you know, recently, New York Attorney General, I think, almost drove them out of New York, where their headquarters used to be. Ancient times. When I say ancient times, I mean since, you know, the time of the founding of the NRA in the United States, they always had a headquarters in New York, or at least a major place of business. And Letitia James sort of drove them out when she asked for depositions, and she filed a lawsuit and wanted to go through their books, things of that nature. And they just said, you know, we're just going to leave New York and go to Texas. And they, I think they declared bankruptcy as well. I believe they did. So, you know, they've been chased out of New York. So in terms of, you know, lobbying power, that's really – Texas is is obviously friendly territory, which is why what happened this weekend, this past week, is such a shock, because it took place in Texas, which is a really big stronghold of the Second Amendment, the Fifth Circuit as well, the district courts there. Probably the strongest gun culture in the United States.
Identified as Salvador Ronaldo Ramos, the shooter easily bought two rifles and hundreds of rounds of ammunition to shoot his grandmother in the face before storming Robb Elementary School. As long as guns are so available, there seems to be no real end in sight for carnage emanating from various reasons, such as racism or mental problems.
The military-industrial complex is integrally involved in the United States, as well as the national security apparatus. That's not really a secret, and unfortunately dictates much of the United States' domestic and foreign policy, unfortunately. It's sort of a death culture, and that goes all the way to the national security apparatus. The military-industrial complex is very, very heavily involved. Also, in you know, for example, with big tech in the United States, which is another problem. I mean, the entire world has sort of pared big tech down a lot with antitrust enforcement. The European Union, Margaret Vestager, for example, and Russian Federation, and a lot of European countries sort of went after big tech, Google, you know. But the United States, unfortunately, big tech is their big advantage.
Republican proponent of the so-called Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution keep promoting the idea of having free and unchecked access to deadly weapons while reaping profits from the business by military-industrial complex. What role does America's military-industrial complex play in the victimization of innocent lives lost in mass shootings?
There are a couple things that need to be understood. On one hand, it is, yes, those perpetrating the crime of these mass shootings, but it's also the law enforcement and how they are actually acting and responding in relation to these mass shootings. We should recognize that roughly 19% of police officers are veterans, okay? When we have officers coming back, completing military service with potential post-traumatic stress, it creates a different type of officer. And, you know, there's a report that came out from the Marshall Project entitled When Warriors Wear Badges, and their conclusions about veteran cops kind of tell us the relationship between the military-industrial complex and what's going on with these mass shootings. These are some of the conclusions that they came to. They said that veterans who work as police are more vulnerable to self-destructive behavior, alcohol abuse, drugs, etc., even attempted suicide.
And now even on the left, people in power have refused to take any real action. Therefore, obtaining guns remains an easy task that could be exploited by those trying to terrorize the fabric of U.S. society. U.S. authorities need to retain the public trust in the wake of these many mass shootings.
There's a spiritual dearth in the United States. I think that value systems have eroded. I think the replacement of God or decency in the schools with Luciferian ideals, with man-made ideals, to replace, spiritual ideals of family and nuclear families, for example. I think that video games, certainly the gun culture, violence in the movies, violence in television, has desensitized people from birth, childhood, all the way to adulthood in this country for decades, where the value of human life is not as respected as they are in other cultures and other countries.
that is probably the most important measure in order to make America look safer than it actually is. This way, they might be able to compromise for the drawback of policing, particularly in the more marginalized communities. What changes need to be made to the U.S. gun laws in an effort to prevent mass shootings and gun violence?
This is a case of a nation of two cities, a tale of two cities. In the urban areas of America, there is no question that automatic weapons and should be considered weapons of mass destruction and treated as such. One lunatic with one weapon can murder so many people. That's why it's absolutely not something that the founding fathers probably envisioned. So there has to be, in major cities, there has to be completely different gun laws than the rest of the United States. I think that's the only way to balance the equation. Unfortunately, like I said, the Second Amendment is so well entrenched in the United States that it's almost as vigorously enforced and supported as the First Amendment is. First and Second are obviously the most important. So, but again, the Founding Fathers did not envision a major city.
Thousands of people die every year from gun violence as more people keep hoarding more and more firearms. The gun business in the U.S. is controlled by powerful lobbies who won't allow gun control laws to pass against their profit. From professional criminals to normal people beside themselves, guns could provide the illusion of a go-to solution to deal with the conflict at hand.
I don't necessarily think that any type of legal changes will do anything of any significance. I argue that, the fundamental change is an educational change. Just as people need to be organized and aware and conscious, people need to be educated on the nature of gun safety, gun violence, and, when to and when not to utilize firearms. I don't think that, I'll make a comparison to the Civil Rights Movement. In the Civil Rights Movement, the argument was that, it is going to be illegal to be racist, to do anything against folks of color. The laws put it on the books, but it still happened. So I don't necessarily think that new gun laws are going to change anything in regards to mass shootings and gun violence.
Committing crimes such as homicide, which is murder, are easier in the U.S. with broken laws providing access to guns for most people. Gun violence, murders, and gang activity all involve getting hold of a gun, and in the U.S., that's truly a piece of cake. And now it's time we see what Abbas Motarim has prepared for us this week.
Last segment of Power to the People, I spoke about the mass shooting in Buffalo by a neo-Nazi white supremacist that left 10 black people dead. I ended the segment talking about how the sad part about these shootings is that they will continue to happen until the violence of American settler colonialism and imperialism ends. And literally not even a week after I recorded the last segment, another tragic mass shooting happened. And this time it was in Texas and at a school, which left 19 children dead. Two adults dead as well. And while this mass shooter wasn't a self-proclaimed neo-Nazi like the Buffalo shooter, the fact of the matter is that white supremacist capitalist imperialism is still to blame, as these mass shootings are merely a byproduct of this violent American society. On this episode of Power to the People, we will get to the root of the issue of mass shootings, which is settler colonial violence. As Imam Jamil Al-Amin once said, violence is as American as cherry pie, and we must understand that a state that is founded on the genocide of indigenous and African people, as well as the enslavement of Africans, will always be violent. America itself is literally the biggest purveyor of violence in the world, from wars to CIA coups to chemical warfare to using nuclear bombs, so it should be to no surprise that there's also constant violence within the belly of the beast. Mass shootings in America, they're a byproduct of America's colonial violence. And if we trace the history of guns in America, it's due to Europeans and the colonization of Africa and the start of the transatlantic slave trade. Europeans used guns to conquer the land and to steal Africans. And then these Europeans, they used guns to form a settler colony in America. Guns were used in order to protect these newly founded European colonies in America. And the so-called United States Constitution, through the Second Amendment, legalized the right for the masses of white European settlers to own guns in order to protect their property, which was enslaved Africans, and stolen land. The Second Amendment of the Constitution says, quote, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Literally, the roots of the Second Amendment is in the protection of the Euro-American slave-holding class as well as their property. And literally every white settler was armed to protect this power structure, whether they owned slaves, land, or anything else. And this is why there's millions upon millions of guns in the street today. And this is the history. And it just shows that American culture is a culture of violence. American gun culture is just a product of settler colonialism and imperialism, and mass shootings are too. But time and time again, after mass shootings, Democrats, or even people, you know, who call themselves progressives, even though they're not, they advocate for gun control. And gun control itself is inherently racist, as it has been a means to keep guns out of the hands of black and other colonized people. Shoot, even the Second Amendment itself was a form of gun control, as it was only legal for settlers, aka Euro-Americans, to have guns. And the people who advocate for gun control, they aren't truly about gun control, because in their so-called advocacy to take guns out of the street, by default, it means that guns should only be in the hands of the state. And America itself is the biggest purveyor of violence, not only at home, but across the world. Literally, America is the biggest arms dealer in the world. Again, this literally shows the contradiction of those who want gun control. So if you truly want to end these mass shootings, you would want to end American settler colonialism and imperialism, because this is what's at the root of these mass shootings. This is power to the people.
Thank you for watching the program with us, everyone. Let's pray for families that lost loved ones in this horrible mass shooting at the school, hoping that such incidents do not occur again. I'm your host, Daniel Aria. Please join me next week with another episode of We the People. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.